Hi, this is Jenny Chamberlain, and welcome to my Southern Utah Housing Podcast. This season, we're talking about attainable housing.
Today, I'm really happy and excited to have Dion Spilker, and I'm going to have David, you pronounce your last name for us.
David Damption.
David Damption from the Utah Housing Corporation. So can we get started by just having you guys tell me a little bit about yourselves and what you do and what your work is?
I'm Dion Spilker, and I am the Vice President of Mortgage Banking, and our goal is to help homebuyers achieve home ownership. And we deal with lenders, realtors, builders, and homebuyers. And we provide a down payment assistance program that helps a homebuyer get into a home.
Jenny, I'm President and CEO of Utah Housing Corporation. Been here for almost 2 years. I was state treasurer before that, and as state treasurer, I served on 19 boards and commissions of the state, one of which was Utah Housing Corporation. So I was on the board for 5 years before coming here full time. Mm-hmm. Absolutely love the organization, its people, and what we do. I had a 20-year career in banking before I joined the state 14 years ago or so as chief deputy state treasurer before I became treasurer. Mm-hmm. Early in my banking career in Seattle, I first got involved in serving the homeless, and then later, after we moved to Utah, got involved in serving the homeless up in Ogden as well. And housing is just such a fundamental need, human need, and there's so many people that are suffering from either cost burden with their current living situation or struggling to have adequate, clean housing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a really exciting place to focus our time and energy. And at Utah Housing Corporation, so Dion mentioned mortgage banking. We attack the full spectrum, really. Helping people attain and achieve home ownership is key. And that's a big part of our focus. That takes us up to people that are maybe at 120%, 130% of area median income. I'm going to jump all the way down to the other end of the spectrum. People that are chronically homeless, we help them as well. We finance the construction of what's called permanent supportive housing, which helps people that are suffering from debilitating mental health and substance abuse issues. And so at that far end of the spectrum with permanent supportive housing, we're helping the chronically homeless. And then in between homeownership and chronic unhoused or homeless situations, you have workforce housing, affordable rental housing, and we help to finance construction of affordable rental housing for working Utahns as well.
Cool. Now, just for those who aren't familiar with the Utah Housing Corporation, is this a private or a public entity, or is it somewhere in between?
Utah Housing Corporation is a public entity. It's a state agency.
Okay.
It's an independent state agency, and what that means is your so-called normal state agency is directly under the governor. And so the director, the senior executive of most agencies are cabinet officers, and they report directly to the governor. Mm-hmm. An independent state agency like ours is governed and overseen primarily by a board of trustees. And those trustees are all appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. So we're entirely governmental, entirely nonprofit, but we're also entirely self-funding. We don't receive, we do administer appropriations. We do administer taxpayer funds for program. But as far as paying salaries, keeping the lights on, that kind of a thing, we earn our own keep. Mm-hmm. And we charge fees, and we have spreads on the capital markets operations that are involved in us funding the mortgages that we buy. And service. And so we're self-funding. We do administer taxpayer money, and we are a public corporation.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up for me, because I hear the word corporation and I think private, but then I know that you guys are heavily involved in a lot of the things that the state is doing.
One of the other ways that I introduce our agency is I will say we are Utah's housing finance agency, and there's only one of us, and most states have only one housing finance agency. Mm-hmm. Some states, like I think New York and California, will have more than one because they have so much density and complexity in urban centers like LA, New York. But in states like Utah, Idaho, Colorado, there's one housing finance agency that does the kinds of things that I described earlier, and that's us. We are the states. Mm-hmm. We're Utah's housing finance agency.
So like all the USDA, RDA, FHA loans under a certain level, is that they all go through you, or you just target more that area?
Well, of course, USDA is federal.
Yeah.
So that's not us.
That's different. Okay.
Yeah, but we're FHA, and Ginny, Freddie...
Yeah, we do, what we do is we purchase the loans from the lenders, mm-hmm. and we purchase the FHA, the VA. We are not participating in the rural housing, but
okay.
we do have a conventional product as well. So what happens is a home buyer will go in on the mortgage side of it, and they will apply for a loan, and it meets all the requirement that FHA requires. And then we guarantee to purchase a loan if it meets the eligibility under certain requirements. And you look, say last year we helped over 3,000 families. And these are families that the 90% of them needed assistance in purchasing a home with down payment. And so we're really excited to be able to help people that we don't believe that there are other entities that may be out there, but we feel that we are able to do it in a way that helps so many more home buyers.
That's great, and I'm so happy that you guys are doing your work. So do you have any stories or cool anecdotes that kind of illustrate the work that you do?
I have so many stories.
Good. Okay, let's dig deep. Let's hear them.
The one thing about what we do at Utah Housing is we hear a lot of stories about couldn't have without you. And mm-hmm. I think we all get pretty stoked when we hear that we are meeting the mission that we set to do. And I think most of us love our jobs for the purpose that we have. And I have a story from several people that have emailed me and told me stories about one in particular that just really stuck out to me was a veteran, actually, and the veteran was disabled, and he was disabled mainly because of the service that he provided to our country, and he was having troubles and getting no, no, no all across the board of people that could help him. And we had one of our loan officers that looked at the possibilities and worked with this veteran and was able to get him into a home. And we also we administer some grant programs and assistance programs. And this one happened to be a veteran grant that he was able to get from this program. And the stories that you hear on the backside about never, ever imagining that this was even possible. We had somebody in Vernal that I heard from that was an elderly person, never, ever had owned a home before, and never thought in her lifetime she would ever be able to purchase a home. And with some of the assistance that we were able and help through the Utah Housing Mortgage Programs, she was able to buy a condominium, not very big, but it was big enough for her. And she was so excited because she was so upset because rents had gone up so high, and this rental or this home that she just bought was going to be a lesser payment. Mm-hmm. And so she was able to now be in a place where her mortgage would be fixed and she wouldn't have to worry about the rental. And I have so many stories like that we could share, but The bottom line is that people we are helping are people that may not have been able to in the past. And sometimes it's not a matter of, you know, the people looking and saying, I can't afford it. But sometimes it's, in some of these stories, it's that we looked a different way. Or we had to look at a townhome. Or we had to look at a condo. Or we purchased a fixer-upper and used the funds that were provided to help do that, because there are programs to fund fixer-uppers that are offered through the FHA program. And so there's a lot of I need the acreage And then I think sometimes we need to look beyond that and look at that first home and possibly what you live in now with mom and dad is not the home that they lived in when they first bought a home.
That's the truth. I was telling somebody the other day, one of the model homes, I said, the master bedroom is about the size of the first home that my husband and I bought when we were newlyweds. But I love how you bring up the idea of being able to buy as something that helps stabilize your payment for a long time, because rent is very, can be volatile and it can go up. So thank you. So since you two work so heavily in the industry, who would you identify as key organizations and people in affordable housing in Utah? And what roles do they fulfill in helping people get affordable housing? Obviously, you guys are playing a big role. Who else are the big players that are helping people get affordable housing?
I think one of the reasons for our independence as a state agency under a board is we need to be entrepreneurial and flexible. And almost everything of any significance that we do can be described as a public-private partnership. We don't sit with borrowers face-to-face. The lenders, that loan officers that we rely on to know about our programs do that. And so we need that, what I would call a distribution network. We need that distribution network to know our programs and to help home buyers identify situations where we offer the best solution. And then what we do in the multifamily space, we rely heavily on developers that are competent, knowledgeable, and understand how to build effectively and successfully some pretty complex projects using a very complex low-income housing tax credit that's federally embodied in Section 42 U.S. Code, and then we have a state low-income housing tax credit. Super complicated. So,
can you tell us like a simple, like if I was an eighth grader, explain to me the low-income housing tax credit? Because I've researched a little. I know that's one of the best practices for affordable housing, but I feel like it is something that's a little bit over the head of most people who are interested in it.
It's hard. So
is it the paperwork that makes it the hardest? Like conceptually, is it just challenging to wrap your head around? Or just so many details?
It's extremely multifaceted. Okay. Yeah. So in a nutshell, I'll first say that the federal low-income housing tax credit was embodied in the Tax Reform Act of 1986. That's probably the biggest tax reform federal legislation in the last century. It was huge. That was signed into law by President Ronald Reagan. And the purpose there was, there was this history of so-called government housing. People usually refer to these big, huge government housing projects
in cities.
Yeah, the projects, like Chicago or New York, whatever. And I don't know a lot about that history. It's not a positive picture in people's minds. And so I think it was an effort on the part of the U.S. Congress to enjoin the private sector, bring in expertise and private capital. And so here in a nutshell is what it is. A tax credit is something that you claim against a tax obligation, right? So it has monetary value, especially for a large organization that has large profits and pays a lot in tax. If they can offset those tax obligations, there's a market. And so we receive applications from developers that want to build affordable housing, and we allocate tax credits to those developers most competitive, most competent, that can deliver on what they promise to do. Once they receive these tax credits, they sell them to investors. And when investors buy the tax credits, the proceeds of that investment money gets driven right into the project. This is equity investment, not debt investment. As you know, debt investment requires payback. Equity investment does not have a repayment schedule per se. And so it's that equity investment that reduces the amount of debt that's required to make the project succeed. And just for like you and I, if we have a mortgage that is 30% of our home's value, we have a pretty small mortgage payment, right? And that's the deal, is these projects get that equity injection, and they have a very relatively smaller stack of debt that they have to service, so they can charge a lot less rent.
Yeah, okay. So they can get like better rates maybe on debt that they do have to use to create stuff.
Yeah, and there's a couple of different types of federal low-income housing tax credit. There's a 9% and a 4%, and the 4% is used in conjunction with tax-exempt private activity bonds. And so that brings it a, you know, tax-exempt borrowing represents a very, very low cost of debt. So,
okay.
Yeah, there's just, these are in a nutshell, these are federal subsidies.
Okay.
And, you know, when we get to offset mortgage interest on our home mortgage, which we're not doing quite as much now since the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but when we could, that was a federal subsidy, right? It it incentivized us to buy and own a home because we could offset, you know, some of the cost of that mortgage interest. And so there have been federal subsidies for affordable home ownership or affordable housing of one kind or another for a very long time, and most of it's been focused over the years on home ownership, which is good, which is great.
Yeah.
But this is just another form of subsidy.
Cool. Thank you. Dion, do you have any other thoughts on who were the other key organizations that work in affordable housing?
I think in the affordable housing, it's a combination of a lot of people. I don't think one group can solve the problem. But if I were to say, I'd say David. He's a big kika. He is very active in affordable housing, but our legislatures. I mean, even these last sessions, what they have done and what they have allocated will help thousands of people, either through tax credits or through purchasing a home and helping with the assistance to purchase it, either through buying down the interest rate or something like that. They've helped law enforcement officers. They provide programs and grants for veterans. So I think the legislature takes a big key, but I also think that cities and counties and the planning and zoning and all of the costs that it takes to build a home sometimes can make an affordable house not affordable anymore. And also locations because of land costs and that. And I see sometimes that citizens, I mean, even each of us individually, in order to promote affordable housing, has to be open to affordable housing in our neighborhoods. And sometimes we get into this type of person's income lives here and this type of person's income lives here. And so I think that we as citizens need to open up and recognize that our kids are going to need a home, like you said. And if we don't partner with the lenders, the realtors, the builders in our cities and get involved in cities and states and promoting it, I think as far as one person or to name an entity, it's hard to do because I think it takes all of us to put together to do the building and to the lending and to do the tax credits and to have the knowledge. In one of the conversations that I've had with a lender recently is back to the veteran story, is that you need people who understand the program. And maybe not every person out there does, but you need to have a contact of somebody that can direct you in the right direction. So if you're not getting the answer that you can, then keep looking, because there's somebody out there that can help you. And it may take a year, it may take a couple of years, but there are great people in the lending community that and the realtor community that will work with the home buyer for a couple years to get them to where they can purchase an affordable or where they can find and be ready when they find that home.
Yeah, I was just noticing a house that came on our local market last night. It was for $300,000. So I was reading the notes and it said, we have 6 offers today. We'll be reviewing them at 5 o'clock p.m. This is its second day on the market. And I just think, It's a real challenge right now. Do you have any thoughts on how, I feel like I can't even ask what my complicated question is. Like, where is the intersection between, like, letting the free market, because, you know, it's hard for us to have, we just don't have the product on the market right now to meet the demand that we have. What solutions do you see that whether private or public can come up with to continue to help? Obviously, the work you're doing is helping a lot.
Well, like Dion said, you kind of need you need all hands on deck for problems of this complexity and this magnitude. And really, if you look at things from a long-term perspective, I'm very much a conservative, pro-free market person, but markets are only somewhat efficient. The stock market, the equity market is highly efficient. The bond market is quite less efficient. And I would say the real estate market is one of the least efficient of all. And one of the primary sources of the situation we find ourselves in is the economic impacts that came out of the global financial crisis 12, 13 years ago. So many builders went out of business. We stopped building, sort of. I mean, that's a broad generalization, but we have such a disconnect between supply and demand right now, and that's partly due to the economic disruption that we suffered in 2008, 2009, and that's referred to sometimes as a market failure. And so, I think, to be honest about it, no matter how capitalistic we might be, no matter how conservative we might be, the market is not perfect. And I don't want to suggest that government is the solution, but I think that smart government working hand in hand with the private sector can be very constructive and very helpful. But you want to have a light touch, because the market is a wonderful mechanism. And I think very long term we'll reattain balance in the market. But in the short term, I think it's good that we have government and nonprofit and for-profit enterprise that can all kind of lock arms and work together.
Yeah. One thing I've really appreciated as I've studied this topic is I feel like generally as citizens, a lot of times we don't even think about how complicated the problem is, because it's something you really have to sit down and study and kind of wrap your head around all these different factors. But I really have loved talking to the planning developers in cities. I feel like they really understand what the complicated solution could be. And I think one of the biggest difficulties is sometimes just allowing, like, helping our citizens to understand and maybe get out of the way a little bit, because, you know, even city councils get to where they understand it because they've been studying it and they want to do things that can help, but the public comes and complains because of the,
yeah,
what you were talking about, Dion. You know, I don't want to see that. I don't want to look at that.
I think it was James Madison that said, if we'd have no need for government if men were angels, men and women. And that's reality. And I don't take a negative view of human nature, but we do have a natural impulse, natural inclination for what I call enlightened self-interest. And we just had a situation in a certain part of the state where you mentioned your service on the planning commission. We have a developer that had an agreement with a city to do a certain amount of townhomes, certain amount of affordable rentals. And there have been some challenges and developers coming back and wanting to renege and then making certain representations to the city about what they can or can't do with tax credit finance. And a real focal point for me right now is meeting with people like you. And I think I might be with the American Planning Association conference in May, I think it is, in Vernal. And then I think I'm going to be with city attorneys down in St. George in like 3 weeks, making sure that city officials know who we are. So if they're being told something by a developer that's using low-income housing tax credit as part of their capital stack to finance affordable housing, so you can call us and get the straight scoop. Because I'm not negative about this person or people in general, but we need balance and we need to kind of keep each other honest sometimes.
Trust but verify.
Or
so we verify with you.
No, as I like to say, trust your neighbors but brand your cows.
Oh, I love that.
Well, and we have this Senate Bill 240 that's coming that goes into effect in July. And the purpose is to bring more affordable units that can be purchased. Now, the way to do that, you know, is the builders need to build more homes and more affordable homes. And I think this bill will help that. And that will bring more units available so that, and I think the limit's $450,000. Some people, that's still not
seems
affordable.
Yeah.
But it's to encourage more development. And it's not something that the government is giving away. It has to be repaid, but it gets somebody into a home with a lower payment that they can do it now. And when they sell the home, then they can repay it. But so it's not us, you know, subsidizing anything. It's just giving them the advantage to be able to purchase something now.
It's really the Utah way. I mean, you look at housing finance agencies in some states, blue states in particular, they like to give the money away. They do grants. And when you're extremely aggressive and liberal about those resources, you're putting a heavier burden on the taxpayer, right? And President Adams, in formulating SB 240, which Dion had a huge role in helping to, you know, kind of curate the program and make sure that it was going to work in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
He and so many other policymakers are really clear on the notion that a big part of the problem is a supply-demand imbalance. And if you come out with a program that helps a home buyer, you're being demand stimulative. And that just exacerbates the problem. What's interesting about SB 240 is it does help the home buyer. At the same time, though, it incentivizes builders to build more products that are affordable under that $450,000 cap.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a balanced approach. And as Dion said, it's not a grant. It's not a giveaway. And so it'll help young folks get into that home and establish that long-term pathway towards wealth accumulation and family stability and higher education outcomes and all the good things that we know come from home ownership.
Mm-hmm.
It'll get them walking down that path, maybe a little bit sooner. And we hope that it'll really stimulate the builder community to look at working a little bit harder to develop smaller tracts. Look at building materials. Is it really so bad to have your first home have Formica and vinyl floors and things like that? Because that's what was in my first house. I didn't have granite. I'm 58 years old, and my wife and I moved into our very first house with any granite countertops 2 years ago. So we lived with Formica and vinyl and stuff like that for many, many years, and we were just fine. It was no great hardship, you know?
Yeah. I'm really happy to hear about people being able to get into things under 450, and I would love to see builders start to use more affordable things. I feel like one of the difficulties I've seen is that because, going back to what you said about Utah being really fiscally responsible and not putting the burden on the taxpayers, we end up having people who've lived in states where they weren't want to move here because our taxes are so low and they love it. it's just one more factor in our complicated problem. It kind of makes me sad, but I'm happy because our team right now, we have like 10 townhomes sitting there, but I think because they're 415, that's still a little bit of a reach for a first time home buyer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just difficult.
We're part of a national housing market, and what's happening because of all of that in-migration from states like California, and I'm not denigrating people from California. My oldest son lives in Long Beach, and I love him dearly, and I want him and his significant other and our grandson to move back to Utah sooner than later. Right?
Who doesn't? I have two.
Yeah.
We have family in California we wish would move back to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And really, to maintain a growing economy, you want growth and ongoing household formation. And we're losing a little bit of traction in those areas, frankly, because our birth rate is slowing in this state. People are waiting to get married until they're a little bit older. They're not able to buy their first home until they're a little bit older. And that household formation, that high birth rate, high level of in-migration, those are key drivers of our strong economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right to be, you know, concerned about that, but it's not something that's going to go away. But what's happening is our home prices are – getting closer and closer to, I don't want to say parity, but we're getting closer and closer to where that relative cost advantage is going to get whittled away.
But I think, too, that the $300,000 home that you talked about, that's where people, as soon as they see something, are grabbing and wanting it. Some of the higher ends are sitting there a little bit longer, but it's still that affordable down in the 300 range. And attainable is, I really like attainable better than affordable because, but it's so, I talk to kids, I guess they're kids because I'm not, but I talk to young people, and even my granddaughter, I was talking to her the other day, and she says, there's no way I can be able to afford a home. And I said, yes, there is, because you just have to change your mindset. You know what you want, but you have to think about possibilities and options, you know, renting a basement or maybe buying a home with a friend instead of on your own. And there were several things that we chatted about, and the size of the home. It doesn't need to be 3,000 square feet. We've seen 1,200 that worked just fine. Yeah. We lived in them. So I think that there's that 300 range is hard also because in order for your borrower that's been looking for 2 years to find a 300 is competing against a program that a seller's going to take over their program. If VA loans are not always the first ones, you know, they're a little bit more difficult. And so I think some of that could be addressed as well on the programs and how to help them get that, and that's what you do.
Yeah, that's good. I think we've actually covered most of the questions I wanted to talk about. So do you guys have anything else you want to add? Any finishing thoughts about attainable housing and affordable housing?
There's a couple things. I would say you had asked about like who's out there. We have a sibling agency called Housing and Community Development. They're a division of the Department of Workforce Services, and we work very closely with them. They run the Oling Walker Housing Trust Fund. They actually administer the Private Activity Bond Review Board, on which I serve, but I have fellow board members and staff there under Housing and Community Development that do all the legwork to allocate to developers that tax-exempt private activity bond, what's called volume cap. It's basically, you know, giving them the ability, the right to borrow tax-exempt. And then Utah Housing Corporation is the conduit issuer of those bonds on their behalf. So I would say Housing and Community Development, that agency of the state, is really, really important. And they have a number of other programs that they do that are impactful on housing affordability. They're huge. And then there's kind of a dark horse player in all of this, and it's public education. Utah was the first state in the nation to pass into law a general financial literacy graduation requirement. Now, of course, the experience that a student has is going to vary from school to school, teacher to teacher. My daughter took the course, and she was a high achiever. She was an international baccalaureate in AP, and she didn't really have a lot of time, so she had to do an online course. And I asked her when she was all done, I said, what did you learn, honey? And she said, not really much of anything. It wasn't a super helpful. That was years ago. I think I know that a lot of work is being done on the quality of the online course. But Dion and I worked with the State Board of Education to add a home ownership element to the curriculum, the strands, what's called strands and standards that are used for the general financial literacy graduation requirement. There are financial literacy teachers out there that are, without being told to, that are talking to students about home ownership. But Dion's been touching on this, and it's something you're keen on too. We really want to plant the seed in the minds of our students when they're young, the seed of possibility and aspiration. A lot of us take home ownership for granted. We live in a home that we own now, and we grew up in a home that was owned by our parents. But there are a lot of folks out there that don't come from that life experience and that see home ownership as something practically out of reach. And we have to change that. We have to help young people learn early on about possibilities and about aspirations towards home ownership.
I love that because I remember when, I mean, we were in our 20s when my husband and I bought our first house, and I remember getting the paperwork that showed the amortization, and I looked at it, I was like, I'm really going to pay that much over the life of my mortgage? And I was just, it was just this big shock for me, and I thought, okay, well, you know, once I wrapped my head around it, I was like, the math in this is not beyond, I mean, I had to take a calculus class in high school. I had to take trigonometry and geometry, none of which prepared me for this basic thing, right. This basic thing. So I love that you brought that dark horse up because I think education is a key component. And I would love it if our kids in high school could see, oh, this is what it takes. This is, you know, and plant that seed, especially for kids who aren't growing up in a situation.
The real magic is not just what you know. And this is the hard part about financial literacy and financial wellness. It's not what we know. It's what we do. It's behavioral and it's hard. There's a professor, Richard Thaler. He's a Nobel Prize winning economist. There's a whole field of study called behavioral finance, behavioral economics. And it studies all of the really dumb things that we predictably do that are not in our best interests. And it's a really important field of study. If we can look in the mirror as consumers and recognize the things that we do that are really not that great, and that we should really change for our long-term benefit. And I think for people in your line of work, whether you're a realtor, lender, you work in banking, insurance, investments, whatever, the more we can do to help educate and empower people with knowledge and also help them understand themselves and those behaviors and help them understand how to develop healthy behaviors and disciplines, so they can be secure and stable and have long-term financial wellness. The more we can do, gosh, the better, obviously. We'll have healthier families, healthier marriages, healthier communities, and a healthier society.
I love it.
And you take that amortization schedule and you show them their rent for that same period of time. And that just keeps going up and up and up and up. And that what they're paying for the rent is a lot higher than what they are on the amortization schedule.
For sure. I keep thinking about what the current rates are rent, and I think my husband and I could pay off our house in like 5 years if we just paid what the normal rent is on our current house. But we've been in the market for, you know, 15, 20 years now.
So. Well, and you just said it, is you bought your first home when you're 20, and you're able to move up because of that equity that you've had.
For sure.
When people and our home buyers and especially the younger kids look at it and think, I can't afford it, like my granddaughter says, is I can't afford it, is I think, how can you not afford it? Because it's just going to it's going to keep going up. And so even on the down payment assistance program that we provide, you know, you hear a lot about people saying, I'm going to wait till I save money. By the time they save that money, can they afford that same house? Usually not.
Maybe not.
Yeah. So I just think that this is, I love the education part, and I like bringing awareness of the possibilities and showing the difference between, you know, what it costs now and what it's going to cost in rent in 5 years.
Yeah. Well, David and Dion, thank you both so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you. Any closing thoughts, or are we good?
We good? I'd like to just bring one more point out of just one of the things that I said that I've heard from one of our lenders, and that is from a person who bought a home from another. She moved in from another country. Never thought again that they'd be able to purchase the home, and the home may not have been the dream home, but it was a home, and she had three little kids, and those three little kids at their closing table drew pictures of their bedrooms that they never, ever had before. And I think that there is possibilities to be able to get into an affordable or an attainable home. And there are people out there that are willing to help do that. And it may not be today, but it is time to prepare today, because it will and can happen, and it is a good thing.
Thank you. I love that hopeful note.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you for listening to the Southern Utah Real Estate Podcast with Jenny Chamberlain. I hope you'll think about subscribing and give the podcast a review. if you found it valuable. If you have feedback or ideas to make this podcast better, check out my website, jennychamberlain.com, and leave me a message there.